Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today, my very special guest is Manfred Ketz de Vries. Manfred is a distinguished clinical professor of leadership, development and organizational change at INSEAD. He's program director of their top management program, The Challenge of Leadership. And Ketz de Vries is a prolific and best-selling author. He's co-authored over 50 books, published more than 400 articles and papers. His work is featured in the New York Times, The Economist, The Financial Times, The Harvard Business Review. And he's won far too many awards to mention. Manfred's also a mentor, a colleague, and a friend, and he's probably the leading voice on toxic and narcissistic leadership in the world. Manfred, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
I'm still alive, huh?
You're still alive.
That's very important.
That's the number one thing. And you're very active and alive. You just shared that you've published over 13 books since COVID. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's crazy, actually. But maybe I told you before that I had once a student who said, if I don't play the piano, I feel depressed. If I don't write, I feel not so good. So yeah, I feel much better when I play with words, usually early in the morning. And after that, I do other things.
Yeah.
And of course, lately, given the state of the world, where we have Caligula of our time, actually quite a few are running around, you get quite concerned. And I get concerned about your children. I'm too old, so I mean, I will not maybe have them, but in grandchildren. I was just telling you also that I'm born in the Second World War, and I became very conscious of what, I mean, since many of my family members have been killed, of toxic leadership. I have strong memory, actually, Simon, which is, that I was, in those days, of course, there was no television. There were the Nuremberg trials.
In yes.
Listening with my grandfather to, I was very young. I was probably, four. And he had been beaten up by the Nazis. He was he got honored at the time later on by Israel for his work. He did for hiding people. It's called the Righteous Gentile. And so I got quite influenced by that, you know. And so that has been a topic which I got quite intrigued by in great part of my life. Although lately I was really for a while somewhat of a specialist in pathological leadership. But at one point in time, one of our deans at INSEAD decided that he set up and is supposed to train leaders for the world. But we had no course in leadership. The only one who talked about leadership at the time was me. So I got bombarded to set up a leadership center. And suddenly I had to shift from toxic leaders to more, what can I do to be people who are pretty okay, but make them even better? I'd written a book which was had some impact, which is called The Neurotic Organization, which I wrote many, many years ago in the 80s. So that was became my general brand name, Toxic Leadership. So I had to shift. And so I got more involved in that. Lately, you mentioned that I was running my, what you call the, one of the top management program. I stopped doing it last year. It's a very intensive program. And I felt I needed some more time because what was really a trigger mechanism was that I got, surprisingly, they asked me to do the lunch with the Financial Times, which is a weekly feature. And I don't think many management professors had been involved in that. And after that, my life became, this was switched because I got so many requests. And I tried,
really?
As I also mentioned to you, I try to preach to people having a balanced lifestyle. But if I don't have it, I'm not believable. So I have to. So anyhow, still, I'm quite, like many of us, we want to help people in the helping profession. And so I do lots of things, try to help people on
solutions
and whatever. And all those things take time. And I'm not very good in always saying no. I'm getting a little bit better in it. Otherwise, I have no life. So that's, although it's always a pleasure to talk with you. That's it's different because in that respect, I always admire the way you ask questions and the way you get the best out of people. So that's the reason you seduced me in that respect.
That's very, very kind. So your childhood and your family influence, the Second World War, death camps, the whole kind of toxic hit. Kind of leadership. What took you from there to psychoanalysis? What attracted you to psychoanalysis?
No, I mean, it's of course, I became I'm a psychoanalyst. I went through this crazy training program, which I think not many people do anymore. But of course, it has to do, why do you become a psychoanalyst? You usually try to solve some of the riddles of your own life.
Yeah.
It's fair. And I come from an divorced family. My father left my mother when I was around 5 years old, and so that really created quite a shock in the family. I've dealt with two solid Jews. My father was quite a successful businessman. He was a president of a company, but my mother had not much money. So it was quite contrasting world, which I think about your own background, which I think makes it easier to talk to all different population groups.
Yes.
People have sometimes accused me that I spend too much time with CEOs, but the reason is very simple. I'm trying to explain to them. My grandfather was a miner. He was living at the time in Germany. He's Dutch, but lived in Germany, and he was exposed to hyperinflation and all the dramas of that time, the Weimar Republic and Hitler's rise and things like that. I think it's kind of funny. I wrote a little article recently about the third place. Your first place is your home. The second place is, of course, the work environment, which has now changed because look at us. We are virtually, we're not together, we are virtually talking. And the third place used to be a cafe or something like that, a gathering place. I always enjoyed that. I mean, when I was a student in Holland, which is 100 years ago, there was a cafe I liked, which was called Hoppe. And you could meet there the mayor of the city, and you could make the locals feminine cheaper. So even though I am quite an introvert, I have learned to become more extroverted. Actually, to say bluntly, many of the executives I had are actually pseudo-extroverts. They realized that to be able to function well, but both sides have advantages, but they have to make an effort to reach out. I like it. I saw also even in Paris, my cafe was Café de Flore, famous for Sartre and de Beauvoir. But it got on TikTok. And after TikTok, you can't get in anymore because there's a lot of tourists that want to get in. And so I had to find a new cafe. I found a cafe called La Palette. I think Hemingway and Picasso used to go there. It's very close where I live. But, I came there and there was a whole line of chairs in front. And I wanted to sit there, empty. No, he said, no, you can sit there. I said, it's empty. No, you can sit there. So I was pissed off and left. The second time I came, same thing. So I said, I have to do something because this is a good cafe. And so I managed on the quiet time to sit in the extreme side of it. By the way, the other side is a group of elderly gentlemen, my age, I guess, smoking cigars and playing cards. They live there. Those are the local art dealers, I think. Slowly I realized what they had done. All those lines reserved are basically people who come regularly. So now come in, I made it. After a week of investment, I made it. And now the owner shakes my hand, then kissed me on the cheek. That's not, I'm not so forward. Shakes my hand, said, hello, Manfred, how are you doing? So, but it's, what I think, what I say about that, it's, I like it sometimes to talk to complete strangers.
Yeah.
Asian. And of course, when you are the reserved seats, they're usually journalists, art dealers, sometimes bankers also. It's an interesting, it's actually an interesting group. You meet passion people. And so you chat a little bit. And it is because we are, and I keep on preaching on that part. And when you think about the most important thing in life, and you know very well, is good relationships with family and friends.
Yes.
Yeah. Sense of belonging. And that's very good for your mental health. And many of the executives I have forget that. Busy making money and so busy having acquaintances or, a business relationship that they don't really have meaningful conversations. And of course, now you hire a coach.
Yeah, sorry. I'm so sure it's a curse. Yeah, cafes is hard. I mean, coffee houses, for many, many years, they're sites of conviviality, they're sites of exchange. They're very important. I mean, I spend my time I do a few hours in front of the computer writing and working, and then I'm on my bicycle to the cafe, and it's you meet a friend, you meet a stranger. It's actually very good, very good, and very different from the screen. So you did psychoanalysis, and then you applied the clinical approach to leadership and to organization.
Let me make it more precise. I studied economics because I guess my father wanted me to become a chemical engineer. And I still remember I was entered the university and a gentleman said, you have to see a place in the laboratory. So he brought me to my place in the laboratory and said, on the average, people stand here 7.8 years. Mm. I was 15 years old. I looked at that and it worked straight out. I said, it was half my life to stand in that place. So then I tried mechanical engineering, but I failed that because I don't smoke, which is a paradoxical statement because you had to do certain things and yet to bribe. I was not smart enough to bribe the locals who work there to give them some cigarettes. And I don't smoke. I was against smoking. And so I decided, when you don't know what to do, you study economics. That's what I did. I finished the study, but I always was curious. When I was 70 years old, my father, who had an office in Boston, was convinced that it would be good for me to go to the Harvard Summer School. So I went to the Harvard Summer School, and I was fascinated by it because you met some people from other cultures. So I also decided to go back to Harvard, which I did after I finished my studies in Holland. I remember I was in an open study program. It's called International Teachers Program. It still exists. And I got had an advisor, and he said, it's a funny course. Economic psychology and organizational studies or something like that by a man called Abraham Selesnik.
Okay.
I always had been interested a little bit in psychology, but as a real dilettante. So I said, why not? And I remember it very well. I mean, never forget. The first assignment was to read the biography of Freud. Maybe I've seen it, of Jones, the 3 volumes. And my English was not very good. But you know, what did I know? I didn't know that you had to wing it. So I spent the whole week reading that enormous, you know, tome. So I came to class, the seminar. Nobody had read it, of course, except me. And then the next assignment was the Wolfman of Freud, you know, this case studies of Freud. And it was fascinated. But of course, I mean, now in hindsight, you look at the Wolfman and the Red Man and say, okay, that was maybe Freud didn't do a fantastic job in completely had some axes to grind about the Oedipus complex and whatever it might be. But I got fascinated by it. And Selesnik was the funny person there because he was originally in production operation management, but he decided to become a psychoanalyst. Well, I mean, talk about the history of some of the organizational behavior studies at the Harvard Business School, but there was a man called, there were two schools there, and I'm trying to remember his name, there was Paul Lawrence, who had the more structural school, Lawrence and Lorsch, and there was more the psychoanalytic school, and they didn't talk to each other. And it was very difficult, actually quite stupid, because they're not either or, but, you know. But I got fascinated by Selesnik, and he had become a psychoanalyst, a lay analyst. And so I decided that I want to do that. But it was not that easy because I needed a job and to pay for it. So I finally ended up at INSEAD. And there I did some psychoanalysis with a very well-known person, Joyce McDougall. But it was quite complicated living in Fontainebleau and doing analysis 5 times a week, by the way, to drive to Paris. So I decided, eventually I ended up, Henry Mintzberg, you might remember him.
I know Henry, yeah.
Actually had an interview with him. I remember I was interviewed, and the other candidate was the man who did some monkey studies. I was into the stress business, I won apparently. So there I did my psychoanalysis really, and was lucky in a way because Montreal was not so orthodox, you know. They were much more maybe of the French orientation, even though it was the English group. And so I was quite diversified, and I actually did it in a record time because I think about other people going through psychology training, they got really abused. I feel I made an. It's funny actually. My second analyst was a man called Maurice Donger, and I met him. In the craziness of psychoanalyst, I was living in Boston. So I interviewed, and they said they couldn't accept me in the class because I was not living in Montreal. They said, but you knew that. Why interview me? I mean, that's ridiculous. Anyhow, at the time, I interviewed 3 analysts, and one was the head of the Allen Memorial Institute, which was the major psychiatric think tank in Canada. That was Maurice Donger. I remember his enormous office, but he was in what he called a mensch. Sense of humor, and he would answer questions, not the other ones, so some of the analyzing machines. So a few years later, when I was a professor, an assistant professor at McGill, he wrote me a note and said, you know, I have a new class, you want to join? And so I took him as my, I must admit, I've always been quite politically naive, and maybe I'm now a bit better after so many years, but I picked him because I felt he was a human being, as opposed to the analyzing machines and the craziness of some. And what I didn't realize by picking him, I was untouchable because he was the head of psychiatry. He was the head of Allen. It was kind of funny. But there was also a man, actually, you probably don't heard of, it was a man called Clifford Scott. He was a very important person in psychology. He was actually the one who brought psychoanalysis to Canada. He was a bearded man. He was a white, looked a bit like Freud. And I remember at the Allen, they had once a week, the patient of the week. So they had a problematic patient. He was interviewed by a psychoanalyst and on closed circuit television. Treating him, etc., nurses, students, etc. And then there was a discussion with another psychoanalyst, a psychiatrist, about what would be the treatment of choice, which was kind of fascinating. It was a fascinating thing. And one of the interviewees was Clifford Scott, who was analyzed by Melanie Klein, Master Melanie Klein. And his supervisor was Ernest Jones. He had a sense of the history. He listened to his interview with this patient, and I rushed off to the couch, to Bonanger, lie on the couch and say, my God, this is crazy. Look at him, straight to the unconscious. How can you do this? Whatever. And he started to giggle, Bonanger at the other side of the couch, and said, give him a chance. And you listen. I didn't realize at the time that Clifford Scott was the most famous analyst in Canada. Okay. Naively, I once asked him, are you a Kleinian?
Right. Genealogy.
Anyhow, so I took him as my first supervisor. And he was the only one who didn't. He likes his patients or his supervisees, and it was very hard to graduate because he liked. Actually, the funny thing was, and maybe you can interpret that. Finally, he realized that I wanted to go. I wanted to graduate because all the other ones, I had just three supervisors. They already let me go a long time ago, but not Clifford Scott. The first one is, of course, the most important one, and you have to learn the longest period with him, at least in the training program in Canada, in Montreal at the time. And the last session, he had this big mirror and he had this big, easy chair. So he put me in his chair, put the mirror in front of me, sat behind me, and we had our last session. You can make lots of interpretations about what was going
on. I think it's very crazy, for sure. Yeah, very interesting. You could take a Lacanian view of the mirror stage.
I know. But he was not my free associate. Lane for a moment.
Something we like on this podcast, we like to free associate. I've been thinking quite a lot recently about there's a lot of analysis of Trump and of leaders. Like we think about their personalities, the word of toxic and narcissistic. How much do you think leaders make followers and followers make leaders? And I'm thinking like Trump, how much is, we can see his personalities. It's not hidden. It's kind of all there in front of us. How much has he been created by USA society and how much is he kind of led those changes, do you think? What's your thoughts on that?
You know the answer, Simon. I mean, countries get the leaders they deserve. I wrote a book a number of years ago when Trump was no longer president called Leadership Unhinged, in which a big chunk of the book is devoted to Trump. Although I call it the little drum boy, it's a little bit of association in German. And I try to analyze his personality. But of course, Trump, he's from a diagnostic point of view, even though you're not supposed to do that when you don't have the person as a patient or a client, is what's called a malignant narcissist, which is a terrible combination of narcissism and psychopathy. We all somewhat narcissistic. You are, I am, we all have that element. It's good for your soul, but it's the excess, of course, which becomes the problem. And I just wrote a book on narcissism. It's out this week or so. Narcissus on the Couch, which maybe is a rehash of some of the... But anyhow, at the same time, he knew how to tap into the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
What is really happening? And you realize that, I sometimes made a comment, what happened in America now, people knowing that he has a character is not exactly an example. It's, in a way, the revenge of the castrated cowboy, to make shorthand. But, there is this macho image of male macho image of the cowboy run saving whatever damsel in distress or the village or whatever it might be, and then riding off in the sunset, masculine image. And that masculine image has been quite perturbed. Women do much better. And education and the role of the traditional role of the man has been changing. And so you can see in America, particularly when you think about the opioid epidemic, lots of people realizing they cannot really support their family. They cannot have a family. Their job is falling by the wayside. And things are tough. And there comes the savior. I just sent you an article just before you. I'm in overdrive the last weeks because of this. I saw this interview with Zelensky and Vance and Trump, and you wonder what Zelensky could have done apart from saying, you're the greatest, you're fantastic, you're such a great man, we are so thankful to you, et cetera, et cetera. Because he's so insecure that he needs an enormous amount of narcissistic supply. And so you get to, but anyhow, that's another story. But I, as you said very well, people are worried. And Trump is very good in playing on the wish to believe. So Kamala Harris comments about the politics of joy. It's fantastic, but she could have been more specific how she brings the joy. And the joy is actually, we come back to this famous metaphor of the egg, the cost of the eggs. And Vance was emphasizing, he's not talking about it anymore because the cost, they keep on rising in spite of the great steps that they both are taking. So now it's, and he tapped into that. And of course, one of the sad thing about Biden was coming back to politics is, you know, he's a stutterer. He always had difficulty in communicating. And he really is probably one of the least communicative presidents. And he never really said all the great things he had done. Yeah. So he shielded because, of course, what happening was that people saw that his mental acumen was declining. And that was, it's a tragic thing. So that combination, because, but anyhow, what I'm trying to say is that the revenge, it was the revenge of the castrated cowboy. Lots of, America is not a democracy because of this electoral college. And so you need a number of people in the swing states who are, and those swing states are where a lot of the opioid crisis was, a lot of drama was, where also comes from, because he is also a product of that. And there we are. And then, by the way, which I always find interesting, that many presidential candidates don't pick strong vice presidential candidates in general. Often they are not glorious. It's exceptions, of course, but I mean, was the person she chose the best one? I don't think so.
No, very weak, very weak. I mean, you wonder, like, was there some sort of unconscious sabotaging going on in the Democrats? I mean, like, we could see what was happening to Biden, but he stayed, and then Kamala kind of took this vice president who was not charismatic or strong personality. So it's interesting to try and make some sense of it.
I mean, you think about the way the Republicans were so much better in communication, and they made a big stink of this wall. And the other thing is about, you know, the gay and other in transgender community. It's an infinite group of people, and they made such a stink out of it. Instead of the Democrats going full blast in that, but now there you say unconscious self sabotage. Might very well be. I mean, that, anyhow, we have to live with it. The sad thing is that we, you know, since Trump is the most powerful person in the world, we had no vote, but we have been affected by it. So it is, the whole thing is, you know, democracy is always a very fragile construction. So the only thing is that you hope that the institutions are strong enough to stand up to certain things.
Yeah.
Like, I wrote an article about rationalizing. We are masters in rationalizing. Of course, some people rationalize. If you rationalize long enough, you start to believe your own bullshit. So that's what comes down. And also, there's also people who see, you know, I'm sorry, people say, my God, with Trump, I'm going to make even more money because he's going to help the rich.
Yeah,
the people who voted for him, the group, the castrated cowboy, they'll be hurt most.
Yeah. And that, I guess, is what will bring him down. If anything, it will be economics, which aren't kind of a, working for those working people who wanted to make America great again, and the price of eggs still go up.
But let's face it, if what you know about the personality of Trump, and he is no, everybody can see it in plain sight, it's make Trump great again. That's the only thing that counts. He doesn't give a damn about making America great. It's all about him.
Yeah. And in Europe, what are you seeing happening in Europe? Like in France, there's a lot of tensions. In Germany, we see things in the UK with Brexit. This is not just in the US, is it? There's something happening across Europe and you know, in India, there's nationalism and different places.
But unconsciously, Trump is actually not a psychoanalyst, as you know. He will not be a good candidate for psychoanalysis. But unconsciously, he has done some paradoxical intervention. Meaning, what I mean by that is that, for example, Germany has been in a winter sleep or whatever, and suddenly they're waking up. I mean, I was very positive about Merkel because she was a pair of safe hands, but she made some very strange move, and she also has not been very good in creating successors. So suddenly, I mean, the real powerhouse in Europe, like it or not, is Germany. Of course, Germany still has to deal with the trauma, what happened during the Second World War, but they have to get their act together because they're the steam engine, or whatever you might call it, of Europe. France, of course, is now, and that's, the problem is that, I mean, I must say the new chancellor made the decision in this little window he has, because it's again a hang jury like in France. You have the extreme left and extreme right. And so people, you know, that's what's happened because of all these alternative facts and all the conspiracy theories. And unfortunately, the social media, we all live in our own echo chamber if we're not careful. Yes. I guess we read a wide variety of newspapers, but many people live in echo chambers. They want to hear what they want to hear. So we split. I've never seen in the past, lived for quite a while in America, Democrat or Republican, so what? No, it's a religious.
It's cultish, isn't it? It's like a cult and that.
Yeah.
Very, very powerful. You know, what are you seeing happening in organizations? I mean, for a long time, you've been talking about kind of leadership and some of the challenges faced. What trends are you seeing in the CEOs you're working with and in the organizations you're working with?
No, one thing, of course, is, which is not unusual, stress.
Yes.
Stress. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that I think there is greater impatience of them to deliver.
Yeah.
It's a high turnover of CEOs. I mean, when you talk about public companies, they're scared to death about the results they show and what would happen if the results are not, the management or that and the business analysts start to make noise. I think it has become harder for many of them to prioritize. And, you know, I'm a simple-minded person, even though people don't think so, but I can keep it simple. And I always tell people, and when my clients, I have a number of CEOs of my clients, say, you know, always think about your 2x2 matrix. Like, don't like, important, not important. So don't like and not important. Don't go there. Why, what are you doing there? Bullshit. Then you have like and not important. Go fishing, you know, go running if you like that. Go swimming. You know, it's good for the soul. My best ideas, I always say, come when I walk in the garden or swim or do whatever other things, not necessarily sitting behind my screen. Then you have important but don't like. And I have a very personal statement about that. You know, you have written books. You know, the book is one thing. But after that, it's a nightmare because then you get the copy editors and you get the queries and you get all those garbage. And by the time, I'm not there anymore. I don't stand it. So I wrote a book called Life Well Lived. And I had a copy editor who sent me all these queries. I answered them, but drove me on. She was persistent. So I wrote her afterwards, said, do you do some freelance work? She said, yes. It's fantastic. She said, I'm a terrier. He's like, no, you're a terrier. So the terrier deals with the terrier. I have nothing to do with it anymore. I write the book. And then said, here, good luck. You work with the copy editor because you're a copy editor too. And they fight it out. It's fantastic. Don't like an important, and that's where the problem very often is. People, if you're not good at it, you should have the minimum knowledge, but don't focus on it. Have somebody else do it. And then, of course, where you can really give you energy is important and like. That's where you should be sitting. And unfortunately, and that you have as a coach, as a psychotherapist, you have to help executives very often to find out where they need to be, given the information overload they have. And that's not always easy for them because they get lost. They get lost.
This is what I'm finding in my work, and I'm working with, I work with a wide variety of organizations. So I've been working with humanitarians, and now I'm working with a car manufacturer. Next, I'll be working with a bank. And it's very interesting to go across these organizations. But what I'm finding with most of them is there's an overload. The kind of complexity of the situation is the same watching politicians. They're overloaded by complexity, and they almost like go into a retreat. They go to some kind of retreat and trying to control the areas they can control. But this complexity seems to be weighing on people very, very difficult. How to navigate through kind of these complex times.
It's very much to the point. I mean, I wrote a strange little article about leadership a la Genghis Khan. Of course, when you think about Genghis Khan, you think about terror. But he was actually, apart from his particular way of conquering, because he was probably the greatest conqueror of all time, he also was an institution builder. People forget that because after his death, you know, the major test of good leadership is how well your successor does, and most people fail. And his empire lived for quite some years afterwards, I think for 30 more years, and then, of course, later on, the children problems and whatever, you get different fights. But I think one of the things as a leader, by the way, as you have been always preaching, leadership is a team sport. Like I talk about the writing of a book, that then I give it to my editor, my one who takes care of those things, so because I'm not so good at it. So it's a team sport. But so, you know, when you talk about complexity, you need some courage, you need some confidence, self-confidence. And of course, we are in the business of creating reflective leaders, not just at all the time, but also say, why do I do it? And things like also the element of how to help the creativity part is also quite important. And of course, I mentioned it already earlier about when you talked about extroversion, introversion, of which I also wrote recently an article, by the way, but that you have to communicate. That's very important. And you may not be the best at it. I remember once I made a typology of different leadership characteristics, which I developed a questionnaire, the leadership archetype questionnaire. And the reason I developed this was that I did a job for a company which became global. The CEO wanted to ask me, what did we do from a nothing company to become so global? What is there about our culture? So I interviewed lots of people, and then I came back to him and I wrote a report. And then he started to talk to me, and I didn't understand him. Now, I'm not completely an idiot, but his language was so complex. He said, how does he communicate with his people? And then I said to him, I just talked to a person who is somewhere in a snowy country, sloshing through the snow. Normally, he plays golf in a sunny environment. He should say, thank you. He's cleaning up the mess there. He said, thank you. He said, that's not me. I'm not going to say that. No. I don't need. So, but then I met him later on in Davos, and slowly the World Economic Forum. And it dawned on me what he did. And coming back to an executive role constellation, he was fantastic in strategic things and deal making. But he had a VP human resources who traveled around the world to say, I love you, I love you, I love you. Because he couldn't do it. He said, not me, I cannot do it. And then he had, when I was in Davos, there was a lady there who worked behind him, a tall lady, remember that, who was his VP communications. She talked for him. So the combination worked. Yeah. It can be everything. Coming back to my 2x2 matrix. And you have to really... And that's what I think we can help as therapists, coaches, whatever, to help people understand what really, where they really add value, and then also see what they need to do to bring in, to make a very well-rounded executive team. I mean, I've been known for team coaching. I mean, that's brought that into our school. I think we are probably the largest institution in team coaching in the world at the moment. And I always say, give me somewhat neurotic executive team and I make something out of it. Of course, there are some situations that becomes very difficult, but in general, I make something out of it. And I think it's important because, the statement, when one person tells you you have ears like a donkey, ignore it. But if 20 people tell you so, I've seen it a number of times. My wife is also a coach and she had a client who she was trying to tell something about. He had to make certain decisions because the thing was stuck in his organization. And so she talked, and he talked, and he talked. It went on and on and on. And she got quite, So finally she decided, why don't you take the course, my course. It was a few years ago. And, there you had, I take always 21 people. So 20 people hammered him. And so the second module, it's a modular course, so it's 4 modules over a year. And the second module, he sent a picture of himself in a samurai outfit with a sword. He had finally cut, because he felt responsible. I had been banging him. And so that what I'm trying to say is nothing about one-to-one relationships and coaching and therapy. But the group, it has sometimes an interest because they're peers. And this interesting effect of pushing people to get, I like to get tipping points. I'm an impatient person.
So you're very skilled at this. I mean, I worked with a family businessman in Ireland, and he went on one of your courses many, many years ago. And I think what he said is that you have a way of communicating with people, and you're very direct, but you're not aggressive to them. So you can say things very strong and very, you can really hit the mark, which is, what a psychoanalyst does, really. That they name things, but it's without attacking them. So you're not trying to destroy the person, but you're saying some truths to people. And when people can hear those truths, it's really, really powerful. And they don't forget it. It kind of stays with them. But it's an unusual skill, I think.
I'm a Morozov, which is, I think, become the wise fool sometimes. I use a lot of humor. That's the reason I have a hard time. I live in France, but I have a hard time working in French because I cannot make the same jokes as in English or in Dutch. So that's a problem I have. But you need, I have to get senior executives to giggle a little bit about it. And actually, you show them extreme scenarios. If they continue this way, what's going to happen? But as I said, before we started, I felt recently I had this discussion with a very grandiose CEO. And that's what's one of the problems. You'd see him become a victim of your own narcissism. Maybe that's a defense on my part, but I think I was right to tell him certain things about what was happening and what's going to happen. What got you, to use the expression, what got you here won't get you there. he had to make some changes.
Yeah.
He said, I'm doing it. He was not doing it. But my only hope is that he will reflect on what I've said and slowly starts to, but sometimes you have those very short assignments.
Yeah.
But there's not much follow-up to say, okay, where are you now? I did it actually. I took the assignment because I felt it was very important for the African continent because of the role he played there. So that's what I did. You know, I mean, you have been in Africa too, and so many messes are going on there.
Yeah, it's difficult. Manfred, it's been great talking with you. We're coming to an end, and I'd like to ask my guests two questions. Any thoughts on what it means to live a good life and create a good society? What's your kind of, you've had a life's experience of working with leaders, and any thoughts at all on living a good life and creating a good society?
In a way, there are two things. A good life, I always emphasize that life consists out of happy moments. You and I should try every day to create a few happy moments, because that's what life is all about. Now, I have made sometimes the analogy of the metaphor of the mosquito. Now, you can, when you look at what's happening in the world and the craziness of it all, you get very helpless. But then I say, have you ever been in bed with a mosquito? Small things can make a difference. And I have been in bed with a mosquito, and I can hear here, this place here, this room here, and I can tell you, I had a very wild night to get at that mosquito. So, what I'm trying to say is, don't give up. You know, take action. I mean, a lot of people think together, maybe you can make some movements. That's the reason also I've been at the moment in such a writing frenzy, trying to make the population more aware of living values. I mean, that's what happened. There was a book in 1958 in America called The Ugly American. JF Kennedy, not the JF Kennedy we have now there, was very much influenced. He was the senator at the time, and he sent it to all the other senators. It was really an indictment of American behavior in Southeast Asia. Now we see another ugly American on steroids, what's going on. I mean, one should take a stand. Like my grandfather took a stand. He said, this should not stand, when he saw what was happening to people. And he got beaten up for it, but in the end, you know, he survived, and he made a difference.
Yes.
So that's what I'm trying to say. Everyone can make a difference.
Manfred, that's very wise. Thank you so much. And thank you for your great contribution and for being on my podcast. Take care.
Okay. It was a pleasure.